Yes, hello again, everyone, and welcome back to None But the Brave podcast. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy, Flynn McClain. Flynn, we start the show off tonight. We're doing this on Friday. The archive came out this morning, and today also marks the 10th anniversary of Clarence's death. Left a hole in the E Street Band that, quite frankly, could never be filled, with all respect to Jake, who I think would agree with that. And we just want to acknowledge the loss for his family, Bruce and the band, and also the fans. Just a remarkable guy.
Yeah, he brought a lot to the stage. He brought a lot to Bruce's music. And he was, I remember Bruce talked about the E Street Band being a bridge to his audience at one point, I guess in 95. And I always thought that Clarence was a huge part of that bridge in and of himself.
Oh, he was such a symbol of the band and of the bond between the band and the fans. When Bruce says he's the biggest man you've ever seen, that was true. I mean, you and I both we certainly weren't friends with Clarence, but we both spent a little time around him, and he was larger than life. There's just there's no other way to put it.
Yes, he was. Everything was big about him, as Bruce said, and his smile was just so huge. And I was lucky enough when I was doing some stuff with E Street Radio I guess it was in 2010, that Clarence came into the studio, and the E Street Radio guy at the time, Tom, said, come on down and meet him. And so my wife and I went down, and we got this amazing picture of him, the two of us with him. And his smile is just so big, and it's a treasured memory for me.
A very generous man. Weren't you guys also at one of his birthday parties?
I wasn't.
Oh, Claudine was. Okay, we'll move on from that. Forgot that you weren't there for that.
It's okay. She went to the, what is it? Was that the one at?
Oh, the God. 50th. No, it must have been his 60th birthday. It was at Foxwoods.
Yes, it was at Foxwoods.
Some crazy stories from that night we're not going to go into on the podcast.
But yeah, they had a great time. And yeah, that was a hell of a show. From what I understand, anyway.
Well, again, Clarence is just so missed. And you think of those nights we stood there in the audience, and he was to Bruce's right, and the sound that came out of his sax, and the joy he brought so many of us, you and I certainly both included. We miss him.
Yes, we do. I mean, Bruce did the best he could. He did the only thing he could on the Wrecking Ball tour, which is you can't replace him with one man. You got the whole horn section going, and obviously Jake took the solos, but it took five guys to fill Clarence's shoes on the next tour.
Yeah. And he certainly is highlighted on today's archive release, which was, as you predicted it in our archives episode, July 1, 1978 from Berkeley. Two of the tracks were used for the King Biscuit Flower Hour many years ago. What is your take on today's release?
Oh, it's fantastic. The sound is just so amazingly clear. And talk about Clarence's sound is really clear, and it's just right there perfectly in the left channel. I feel like I'm looking at the stage, and Clarence is right there blowing the sax. And obviously the Darkness Tour was so full of Clarence's signature solos. You know, you got Badlands, you got Promised Land, Jungle Land, and he's all over this one. It was very fitting. I don't know how intentional it was to release this one on this date, but it's very appropriate.
It worked out well. And Night, don't forget Night, which wasn't played much on the Darkness Tour. Very muscular version.
Yeah, it was something I think, forget which one, Eric or Chris in their respective essays pointed out that Night was only done in the early part of the tour. And we're glad it's represented here, because it does sound pretty damn good.
I've listened to a good chunk of the show. Now, one of the things that caught my ear, Chris wrote about on Backstreets, the altered lines in The Promise after he dedicated the song to his pop. And this is one of these fascinating things. And it speaks to really why our show exists. And the lines about how he learned real good to tighten up inside, and I don't say nothing unless I'm asked. And when you think about it, coming from the perspective of 2021, of course, we know he's overcome that. Now, he has spoken very eloquently about this, years of therapy, and He obviously tells these stories also in the Broadway show, as well as other platforms like his book. And it's really remarkable to hear those lines sung in 1978 and knowing what he's been through to arrive at Bruce at 71, going on 72. It's just pretty amazing.
Yeah, those lyrics really hit home, not just for Bruce, but I'm sure for a lot of people. And to me, when he does those, that verse, that's a better performance right there. And I think as you just pointed out, it's very rare for that verse to be performed, especially in 78. And I don't think it's been done in the reunion era at all.
No,
I think there is a version on the Darkness box on that Thrill Hill vault disc. Mm-hmm. There's a video of the band playing the song in the studio. And he does it then. And that's probably my favorite version of the song, because it's the band and it's got everything in the lyrics. The verse about his father, and then about sleeping in a car, and whatever that line is at the end of the song.
Right. Well, I want to spend...
having trouble remembering.
Oh, it's fine. I don't think anyone's going to hold it against you that you didn't remember that.
Well, just my Rain Man reputation just erodes year after year.
I'm going to spend a little bit more time with it. Maybe we'll come back to it in the next episode. And this is a show that was never bootlegged, really. So it's really all of our first experience with it. Very impressed with what I've heard so far.
Yes, there was a soundboard of the first set, and then most of the encores. But as you point out, yeah, we didn't know what exactly was in the second set. So you've heard the first set before; it's the second set you've never heard.
All right. Well, I'll pay special attention to that then.
let me make one comment on the sound though. This is kind of frustrating. Mm-hmm. As I said, I think it sounds absolutely fantastic, and I'm really enjoying it. I mean, the one listen I've been able to give it, but the in-between song banter from Bruce is just so low. I can barely hear it. Because there's some cool stuff there. He's talking about the Matrix, talking about the joke about, I'm from New Jersey. What's that? It was just so low to hear. And it's kind of frustrating, but, it just doesn't take anything away from the music. So I'll let it slide.
Oh, I didn't really notice that. But as I said, I haven't had much of a chance to listen to it yet. I'm still working through it. But again, maybe we'll come back to it. Now, there is something else new to discuss. This was a bit of a surprise. Bruce with the Killers on a song, Dustland. I guess they originally put it out. It was called The Dustland Fairy Tale. And now it is called just Dustland in the version with Bruce. Now, I got to be totally honest. I'm not the biggest Killers fan. When you told me it was an older song that was being re-recorded, I went back and listened to the original version. I didn't think much of it. And I can't say that I feel a burning passion for what has been done in the version with Bruce either. Did you have a different feeling than I did?
Well, I guess it sounds like I like the Killers more than you do.
I think that's safe, yes.
But yeah, this one didn't grab me the same way, say, Chinatown did late last summer, which he did with the Bleachers. I mean, it was cool. It was good to see him in the video, even though it was obvious they were never in the same room together. But yeah, I should give it another couple of listens just to be fair to it. But it wasn't something that grabbed me from the get-go.
I listened to it three times, and I was like, whatever. But it's just good that he's keeping busy.
Oh, that's for sure.
Of course, one other thing we should discuss is the return to Broadway. Springsteen on Broadway will be coming back for 30 shows starting June 26th, it is, right?
Yes.
Pretty exciting, unexpected in a way, but makes total sense, especially since he's helping them reopen Broadway.
Well, it's I'm not sure I recall how excited I am about it, but it's good to see him playing. I mean, based on his conversation with E Street Radio, he really hadn't reviewed the show since it ended. And so I wasn't exactly holding out hope that he's going to vastly overhaul the whole show. But it sounds like he's going to look at it to see what needs to be reviewed.
I don't think there's going to be much in the way of changes. It's a Broadway show. It was a fixed show pretty much the entire first run. Maybe now he's got some material that could conceivably fit in. I'm thinking specifically of I'll See You in My Dreams, which of course, after what we've been through for the last year plus. But I would think that any tweaks he makes are going to be relatively minor.
Yeah, he talked about making it shorter, but really, the only stuff he added was dialogue or
He was talking about this. He was talking about the script, I thought, when he said that.
Okay, because the song stayed the same. At least a number of songs stayed the same pretty much, I mean, the entire run.
Oh, it's just, all the show was entirely the same on the nights that Patty was there, except for he made that change to Jode from Long Walk Home. So that was after the show opened. In the previews, which of course people do on Broadway, he tweaked the show a couple of times trying to find the show that he wanted. But once the show opened, it was a show.
Right. And I agree with you. I don't see anything changing except maybe adding in I'll See You in My Dreams. That would certainly work. He was at the end of the show. He talked about visiting with his dad and his aunts and Clarence and Danny. So it would make sense to use that as an intro to I'll See You in My Dreams, because that's exactly what it is.
The Born to Run ending, though, was pretty perfect. But let's see what happens. We got a couple of weeks and I guess we'll see what the show is then. Now, in that E Street interview, he did another notable piece of news. He referenced a release that would be coming out in the fall, not new music, from The Vault that fans would enjoy. Now, unfortunately, they didn't really follow up after he said that. You would have thought the next question would have been perhaps, Bruce, can you tell us a little bit more about that? But that did not happen, so we will wait to learn more.
Right. I got the impression he had more than one project in mind when he was talking. So I got the feeling that maybe there'll be one this fall and then one sometime early next year, maybe to coincide with the tour or something. Did you get that impression at all?
He definitely mentioned at one point in the conversation a release in the fall and then a release next year. Then he sort of went back and then he oddly asked, has this been announced already? Like, he didn't know if it had been announced, which one would think that they run these things by him. We know they do. So I don't know what was going on specifically there. But the bottom line is we got a little tease, but no further information.
That leaves that whole Western set album that he talked about a few weeks ago kind of remaining unresolved somewhere, at least for the time being.
Yeah, what he was talking about for the fall did not seem to be that, but that's just my read. And again, it was pretty sparse what he said. I think everyone is now pointing to Tracks 2, and certainly you and I hope that it's going to be Tracks 2. And
third time's a charm, right?
Yes, and I guess that's the perfect lead into our discussion tonight, which is about the first Tracks.
And of course, we're going to start with Disc 4 of Tracks, just to keep things really interesting. And obviously, that's the disc that has all the stuff, the outtakes from Human Touch and Lucky Town, as well as going more into 95. But right now since we've been talking about the 92 album, let's talk about those outtakes.
Yeah. And I listened to Tracks Disc 4 yesterday straight through, and it must have been the first time in 15 years or so. And really, it surprised me because there are a couple of cuts on here that I don't think I ever gave enough credit to. Now, we'll get to that in the body of the show, but there's some really good material here, and it really does, again, point to his decision-making process in the early 90s, because I would have to say he left off some songs that should have been on Human Touch for sure.
Yeah, and he acknowledged that in one of the interviews in 98. About how some of the stuff on Tracks is better than the stuff that was on the 92 album, or at least the Human Touch album. One way I look at it, at least on discs 2, 3, and 4, is that the first X number of songs constitute what would have been an additional disc or another album from those sessions. You can definitely see an album starting off with Leaving Train and ending with Going Cali. Now, I would replace one or two songs in there with 30 Days Out and Trouble River, but I think as an album that works pretty well.
Because it doesn't have Human Touch in particular, I still favor, I think, the album that was released. But and as we get started here with Leaving Train, this is a better song than several songs on the Human Touch album, including the song that it most closely is associated with, The Long Goodbye.
Well, first off, I'm not saying this should have been released instead of Human Touch. I'm saying that it could work. It works on his album as an album in and of itself.
I would agree with that.
And that is really, it constitutes like a diss two of Human Touch.
I don't know if anyone wants that, but.
Well, that's what it is. And it works. I think it works very well as that.
It is cohesive in a way, I think, that perhaps the Human Touch record was not. But why don't we discuss the individual tracks? What did you think about Leaving Train?
I have to agree with you. I think it's better than some of the stuff on Human Touch. I mean, Glorious Eyes, even though I praise the synth in the Boston 92 release, it could definitely replace that. It could replace All or Nothing. It could even The Long Goodbye, which is actually my favorite of those three.
Yeah, the thing about Leaving Train to me is that it really is a relationship song, whereas I correct me if I'm wrong, The Long Goodbye really does seem to be much more about his goodbye, and in a way that also ties it to another song that we're going to discuss later in the show, which is Going Cali. But the overriding theme here, I think, is still about his departure. Would you agree with that?
That's interesting. I had not looked at it that way. I was looking at it that he was talking to a romantic partner here.
I definitely get that.
But and what I found interesting is that between Leaving a Train and Seven Angels, the man or the narrator is being critical of his partner. And you don't see a lot of that on the Human Touch album. On that album, it's more like he's the one that's done the screwing up.
Oh, and it's good that you point that out, because that's another thing that struck me. For all the talk that Bruce has said over the years, people didn't like my Happy albums. There's plenty of material here on this disc, tracks four, that is not Happy. And
no.
far from it. I mean, when we get to I Gave It a Name and stuff like that, what is interesting about it is that he did have the songs that wouldn't have been, you know, these traditional Happy songs, and he chose to leave them off. And maybe he did that intentionally because he wanted to present that his life was changing and these things were happening. Obviously, we know he got married, he had children, and everything that followed from that. But there are some strong songs here.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And Human Touch could have been a much better album,
now,
just to put it bluntly.
Yeah. Well, you talk about replacement. And to me, Seven Angels is like a propulsive rocker. And then you compare it to something like Gloria's Eyes, which I know when we talked about it a few weeks ago, I refer to it as generic rocker.
Right.
Seven Angels has a much more interesting feel to it. In every way, the lyrics, certainly musically, I wonder why he left it off.
Again, I think my only thought on that is that he was being critical of the person or his romantic partner that he was talking to, especially the last line, Seventh Angel says you're a liar. But other than that, I can't think of a reason. It rocks. It really rocks. And when he played at Mohegan in 2014, he let Gary take center stage, and the bass is very prominent on the song.
And Tommy Sims would have done a good job on that as well.
Oh,
on the 92-93 tour. Tommy Sims is an excellent bassist.
And I envisioned Seven Angels as being as easily replacing Gloria's Eyes in the live show in 92, and it probably would have been a slightly better show, but it's because it has the same kind of driving.
Oh,
guitar.
It would have been a much better second set opener than Gloria's Eyes. There's no question about it.
Okay. Well,
I don't think anyone, I wonder if anyone would argue with that, let us know on Twitter.
Okay. But then it had the same feel of the song at the end, where it kind of breaks down into just drums. And to me, that parallel is just too big.
The parallel to Gloria's Eyes?
Yes.
I really like the storytelling in this song and the way he goes through the seven angels. And of course, the hook in the song musically, it's pretty unique for him, especially because of the way the bass is driving the song. Now, we know there's also a host of songs that were written on the bass that we're going to discuss here from tracks disc four, but still for a rocker, it is a most unusual sound for Bruce.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very different. I don't think, we're just talking about the bass right now, but I also feel he hasn't really let loose with guitar like this, or at least have a had a guitar driven song like this, for a while, or maybe even ever.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we'd have to go through that. We'd have to go through that. I don't know if I'm prepared to declare that. Let me think about it a minute.
I mean, a lot of the songs, powerful songs from the classic era, is very much drums and piano. It's Max and Roy, and then it's almost like Bruce and Steve and Nils's guitars are kind of filling in there. It's not really the drive of the song.
All right, I'll buy that. Yeah, okay. I would say that. I mean, as I said when we started the discussion, it's there's something propulsive about it. It would have been an interesting addition to the live show. Obviously, having been listening to Boston 92, which, as we discussed in the last episode, is very, very solid. But you think of the second set opening with this track instead of Gloria's Eyes, the show is better. I don't think there's any question about it.
Yes, that is. Got to agree. It would have been an upgrade.
Now, the next song, another song that certainly wouldn't qualify as happy, it gave it a name. Now, this song has an interesting history because apparently they couldn't find it when they were looking to do tracks. So Bruce re-recorded it in 1998. To me, this song has overtones of Two Faces as well as the Big Muddy. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Big Muddy because...
Well, they share a line.
Well, yes, they talk about the Paris Trout line. But what I was thinking was, remember how I was somewhat critical of Bruce talking about morality? You know, not everybody is afforded morality. And I thought, well, gee, Bruce, you cheat on your wife. That's not, you know, that's not exactly life and death there. But I think between Gave It a Name and When the Lights Go Out, you actually have more of an argument for that kind of moral ambiguity.
Oh, I totally agree. And you get in these songs here, he is working out some stuff that had taken place that didn't wind up on the records. Now, again, it's an interesting choice on his part. We should probably talk a little about what might have provoked that, because he did have what I think are fairly high quality songs here. And maybe he didn't want to go there. Were these songs too dark for him? And at that moment in his life with a new wife and new children, he decided, okay, that's not what I'm putting out into the world now.
I think we also need to point out that Gave It a Name was actually part of the bass-driven songs, along with Over the Rise, Lights Go Out, and Loose Change, and Going Cali, of course. Mm-hmm. And so obviously we would have loved to have heard the original Gave It a Name in that kind of bass arrangement. And it still would have been a very dark album right there.
Between it would have.
Gave It a Name, Lights Go Out, Loose Change, that's dark.
I wonder, is there any evidence that he ever thought about grouping these songs together? As we know, he was being very prolific in this period, 92, 93, 94, 95. We've talked about all the various projects. But I don't believe these were included in any of those projects. Do we have any knowledge on that?
Well, he did mention about having this group of the bass songs that could have been an album. It could have been a genre album. So it wasn't something that he wanted to really go forth. We talked about this, I think, in the Human Touch episode, right? Mm-hmm. Where he, a whole album of that kind of stuff, of that kind of bass-driven, bass-focused material, would not have been very conducive to going out on the road, which is
right. I do remember that now. Yeah.
Right. And so it sounds like he had at least half an album of that stuff done. I mean, between Gave It a Name, and the other four or five. So it could have worked, and it would have been different. It would have been much different than what he had been doing with E Street. So it would have been a departure, but I don't think it would have allowed him to do what he really wanted to do on the road.
Now that we're talking about it, it's surprising that none of these songs ever showed up on, say, the Devils and Dust tour.
Well, somebody may have given him a request on the back of a business card at one point, but
for what song?
For Loose Change, but
was that you?
Yeah, but obviously it didn't go very far, and that would have been something. That would have given that tour, or at least that kind of a wild card, a much darker feel than most of that kind of stuff out of left field that he was playing in 2005.
Now, ironically, I think the next song, which is Sad Eyes, that, if I recall, that was played once on the Devils and Dust tour, right?
Yes, it was in Atlanta.
should have been played more.
Well, we say that about every song, but but yes, it should have been played more at some point.
As we touched in the Human Touch episode, Sad Eyes is a quality song, and had it been written perhaps at another point in his career earlier, could have very well been a hit. And other artists have, I have to go back and look, who's covered Sad Eyes? There's been a number of Sad Eye covers, correct?
Yes, I was going to say that my favorite Springsteen cover or cover of a Springsteen song is Sad Eyes by Enrique Iglesias. I thought his pop version that came out around 2000 was just phenomenal. I mean, I love pulling that one up every so often and just getting into it.
This is another very, I don't know if I should use the word sweet, because again, there's trouble beneath the surface here,
always.
But it's beautifully sung. And this was a song that was really underappreciated, and maybe because it was buried in a release as big as Tracks. And of course, on disc two and disc three, there were songs that fans had been waiting for decades. So something like this is not going to get the same level of attention when people are listening to Restless Nights released officially for the first time, I don't think. But this one really, and I know we say it a lot, but this one not only should have gotten more attention, I think, from the fans, it should get more attention from the performer.
Well, the problem there is that it's not, there's no E Street sound. It's more of a pop sound. And
that's what makes it interesting.
Right, it's what makes it interesting, but it also makes it very difficult for the E Street Band to play at this point.
Oh, I think the E Street Band can play this. I would like to hear them try. It probably won't happen.
Well, I would love to see them try all this. I mean, if they came out and said, we're doing Tracks Disc 4 tonight, I'm going nuts, you know?
Well, that would be what's got a less of a chance, Rising Tour Archives or that?
Yeah, good point. But the thing about Sad Eyes is that, you're right, it would have been a hit. Had it been released in 1991, in the summer, it would have been a huge hit. And one thing I found interesting about the arrangement is that it's basically a slowed down version of Man's Job.
Yeah, I think it does have a similar feel, but just in a slower pace.
Yeah, and it's very poppy. That's what it comes down to. And it's not something he's really done a lot of. And yeah, maybe that's one of the reasons it really works here.
I really like it. I've always liked it. I don't know.
You.
I mean,
it's 100%, man.
Look, he could never play all the songs we want him to play. We get that. But a quality song like this, other performers, this would be a standout. But
yes.
Look, the guy's got 500 songs and a lot of them are standouts. So Sad Eyes, unfortunately, it is what it is.
All right, so which song on Human Touch does this one replace?
That's a tough one. I mean, I certainly, now that I've listened to Tracks Disc 4 again, I certainly would have replaced The Long Goodbye with Leave and Train. As we discussed, I would have left off Gloria's Eyes in favor of Seven Angels. I don't know. I mean, in a way, would Sad Eyes, if it had been paired right before or after with Every Wish, is that too much?
That's a good question. I was thinking Soul Driver myself.
Well, I was just talking about in terms of placement, where I could see it coming.
Yeah,
Soul Driver, I think Soul Driver, as we discussed, is an excellent song and a very, very poor arrangement on the record. I wouldn't have wanted to pull it off only because we know it went on to be played in its darker arrangement on the tour, and I think that was a worthy addition every night. I don't know what I would have left off for Sad Eyes. There's really, in a way, even though I like Cross My Heart, it does seem to fit in that space.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. I can definitely see that. That works.
So I'll go with that one.
All right. Okay. I'm thinking Soul Driver. But just like, I think it'd be a great, would have been a great track too on Human Touch.
The next song, which is My Lover Man, this is an interesting one. I listening to it, and this one always evokes a lot of conversation just because he obviously is singing from a woman's perspective, which he has not done very often.
I think it's only one of two times he's ever done it, right?
Yeah.
Well, the other one being Car Wash.
Yeah. Now, this one, When I was listening to it, though, I really wonder if this was not written for Patty, because I tried placing her voice singing this song, and to me, it would work perfectly. So maybe that was what he was thinking when he wrote it. And in a way, that would have then, it would create something interesting, because she would be singing a song that he wrote, which really then, if she were singing it, I guess would make it about his foibles.
That's true. That's a good point. And the way I looked at it when I was listening to it now was that maybe it was a songwriting exercise. Maybe somebody said, maybe his therapist said, "Hey, Bruce, why don't you write a song from the point of view of some of the women you've dated over the years or been married to?"
Oh, that's an interesting one.
And, you know, what they would be thinking when you pull the girl, your stunts.
Well, you know? Yeah, now that you're saying that, and I read the first two lines, "You treated me hard and made my heart ache. I know you're only human, and men, they make mistakes." That's really interesting what you're saying. And if you think of it then in that guise, could he be writing it about almost from Julianne's perspective?
Possibly. I was thinking of any of the women he was involved with basically for those, you know, 30 years before he met Patty.
When he had the same relationship over and over again.
That's it. You got my reference. Very good.
Yeah. I did get it. We're in sync here, Flynn.
All right. And of course, the fact that it just sounds like Brilliant Disguise doesn't really help it that much either.
Yeah, this is not one of my personal favorites, even from this disc. If it was a songwriting exercise, I get it. As a song, I don't think it's anything great.
No, it's this one's kind of generic in a way, especially after you remove the songwriting perspective out.
The next song is another one of the bass songs, and that's Over the Rise. What do you think of this one?
You know, I'm still having trouble figuring this one out.
Yeah, me too. This is, again, not one of my favorites. And there are a couple of tracks on here that really did surprise me with their power. One of them is coming up. But this one is just, it's sort of weird.
Yeah, there's a lot of dark imagery, and it definitely has a very dark feel to it. But I can't exactly tell where he's going with it. It's interesting, but I can't really wrap my head all the way around it just yet.
Again, not a happy song. At the very end of the song, he's searching the pillow next to him for the tears that they cried, the couple in the song.
Yeah, it's very, very dark in there. There's no happiness here. And it's interesting. I like the opening lines about walk along the levee and see the gypsy man. I just like that imagery a lot.
Yeah, it the gypsy man imagery is pretty cool. In the next verse, they're standing at a wishing well. "Our wishes like dreams, baby, into the water fell." That's cool, but I don't know that the song, as we're saying, ever fully comes together.
No, I don't think it does. There are some elements that are cool that I like about it, the darkness, so to speak, about the lyrics and the music, but it doesn't quite. It's almost like it's still a demo in process.
Yeah, this is one. It doesn't seem fully realized, and it's interesting that it winds up on tracks, because we know there were some other songs, perhaps, although I guess those would be for probably the relationship record that didn't make tracks.
Well, it looks like he didn't consider anything from, or at least we don't know of anything that he considered for tracks from the relationship
right.
album.
This it's said to be the alternate route to the albums he released. So I guess right. all of these songs would be at least tangentially related to the Human Touch sessions.
Well, it was recorded in 1991.
Yeah.
Early 91. So it's definitely part of the Human Touch sessions.
Well, I guess my distinction would be, because as you were saying, he recorded a bunch of songs on the bass that could have made up the heart of a record. And ultimately, he didn't think that was right for touring. Even if they were all part of a larger sessions, are they the same record? That, I guess in his mind they were, and that's why these songs wound up on tracks.
Right. I mean, maybe he only got to the five or six songs and said, yeah, this is kind of enough of that.
Along the same lines, and we're going to discuss this a little bit later when we get to the closing track, Brothers Under the Bridge, that, of course, was an outtake to Jode. There was a whole separate set of sessions at that time, the daytime sessions we've discussed, and he apparently did not take anything from those sessions, which comprised a different record, four tracks. So that sort of proves the same point.
Right. Well, that was the frustrating thing about tracks at the time, is that they were all outtakes from known projects. There was nothing you know, say from the 87 Nashville sessions, or as, you know, as, or the 94 relationship album, or the country swing album that I think is also known as the daytime album from the Joad era. So hopefully the next tracks too will focus on projects that, that never made it out of the gate.
Fingers crossed, but we won't go there right now. We'll stick to tracks one.
Well, we've already discussed tracks two today anyway, so.
That's true.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
The next track is When the Lights Go Out. Now, this is a particularly interesting track, especially the Genesis. We know was written on the bass. He then played it at the Christic. I hadn't heard this song in a while, at least the studio version. And again, this one cried out to me, like, I would like to hear this re-recorded with the E Street Band. I think it's, there's some good songwriting in here. I don't know that the bass-driven element of this particular song works totally for me. How do you feel about it?
Well, as usual, I like these things. I like what he released. But when you point out, or when you point out that it could be recorded by the E Street Band, I feel it could be recorded in some kind of like paranoia arrangement. Like,
yeah, that's exactly. It's a little too bouncy.
Right. So, you know, pull in something like State Trooper from 84 or Run Through the Jungle in 81. Something
totally.
That brings that like a real paranoia about when the lights go out, what happens.
This is one of those things. I don't think we know exactly when this was recorded within the sessions. And so we don't know if it became before Soul Driver in Real World, but this song is afflicted with the same problem to me. It's just the arrangement is too bouncy for the lyrics. And this is one of this one is particularly dark. And I think what you're saying, like a Run Through the Jungle sort of thing, would be perfect.
It's interesting. I never found it bouncy. I hear what you're saying, but that riff to me is more.
It's not as bouncy as, say, Soul Driver.
Right. It's more scary and foreboding than something really upbeat and pop, like, you know, like the Soul Driver tune, as you just said. So I never thought that was the problem with it.
The tracks version never fully worked for me. I think that when you look at these lyrics and there is some really cool ambiance here. Now you say you have a friend, you trust him with your life, you trust him with your money, you trust him with your kids, you'd even trust him with your wife, but yet apparently the friend is not completely on the level when the lights go down. So I agree with you fully that maybe bouncy is not the right word on this one, but it should have been more ominous.
Okay. All right. That works. I think he got almost there, but not all the way. And I think it also provides more evidence as to why a bass-driven album just would not have worked in and of itself at that point in time.
Yeah, I don't think it would have worked as an entire record either. However, there are individual songs, and one of them is the next track, which is Loose Change. Loose Change, again, I hadn't heard in a while. What a powerful song this is. I mean, it just totally forgotten. This song, it knocked me out listening to it yesterday. I was outside, it was a beautiful day, and I was going through these songs, and Loose Change came on, and I was like, I just never appreciated this song enough.
Well, I loved it from the get-go. I think the feeling, the atmosphere, the ambiance that he captured with both with the music, and then the lyrics, I mean, talking about going to these bars, and she, you know, I knew she was trouble, but trouble sure was looking fine. He was really, I mean, he was describing himself, probably, for the and to some extent, about trying to break out of old habits and start something new, and just how difficult that was.
Thematically, doesn't it cover some of the same territory as The Little Things That Count? And which is also about a bar hookup, no?
Well, but to me, Loose Change, there are these loose hookups, so there are at least two,
right?
And okay. But and there's no real connection other than old habits of just hooking up just to hook up, and whereas in The Little Things, it's kind of, he makes it cute, he makes it funny. This woman obviously has a thing for him in the song, and it's supposed to be humorous at the end where she sticks her tongue in his mouth, and
right.
I don't hear any of that. And to me, that it's the last verse of this song about, you know, sitting at the traffic light and goes from red to green and red and back again. And
love that so much.
It's so powerful. I mean, I can imagine him sitting in his car and at 3 o'clock in the morning at some deserted intersection, just trying to find the strength or the will to make a big change. And I see it as being, you know, pretty much a very personal song.
Yeah, and he's telling it in the story. It's personal, but in the story, he wasn't really... Brian Hyatt points this out in his book. This was not the type of writing Bruce was really doing at the time, and this one sort of comes out of nowhere, and it's so highly effective.
Very, very. I mean, I actually think back to... It reminds me of the summer, like, between high school and college when I was, you know, trying to figure out what I wanted to do and all that. And it really hits home in that respect. Cause I remember driving around, you know, late at night, trying to figure out what to do.
It's a song that really should have probably been elevated from its position here.
Mm-hmm.
As far as we know, he's never thought about playing it. Now we forgot to mention when we talked about Gave It a Name, we actually did hear him soundcheck at Mohegan, Gave It a Name, which was really bizarre to suddenly be in the venue and hearing that sound check. But as far as we know, Loose Change has never been considered for performance, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, looking at these songs, it looks to me, outside of Part Man, Part Monkey, and Back in Your Arms and Brothers Under the Bridges, only like Leaving Train was sound checked a few times. Seven Angels was played at Mohegan.
Leaving Train was also played with Grishacki at a couple of those shows.
That's right, in 14, that's right. Okay, and then Sad Eyes that one time in Atlanta, but you know, no Loose Change, no Trouble in Paradise, no When the Lights Go Out since Christic. So this is almost a forgotten disc in terms of live performances.
Okay, well, let's get the Trouble in Paradise, which probably is best left forgotten, but that's just me. This one is not what I would call a high-quality Springsteen song, and it's interesting that he put it on the tracks. I probably would have left it off. Maybe there's someone out there who likes it. How do you feel about it? It doesn't work for me.
All right, well, it took a while, but it works for me.
Okay, why?
Because I kind of see it as an apology to Julianne. I see when he's, I'm sorry, baby, I didn't see the signs, and he really gets into the blue-eyed soul thing at that point. You know, that's one of his apologies to Julianne.
I see what you're saying, but I don't know what the right word would be in terms of the lyrics. I'm trying to think now on the fly. Is it trite?
Well, what I think of this song is that Bruce, when he was talking to Rolling Stone in 92 about what happened between Tunnel of Love and going to California, he said he was trying to write some stuff, but it ended up being like Tunnel of Love, but not as good. And to me, that is this song, you know, perfectly described.
That's fair enough. I don't know. This one doesn't really work for me. I mean, the whole... The first verse, you know, I used to joke about it, you know, that they were going to have pantomimes on stage.
yes, I remember that.
Acting out the lyrics. I don't know. This one doesn't work for me. But, hey, they're not all going to work for me. That's just the way it is. And art is received differently by different people.
Right. And again, I always want to hear something than hear about something. And I think this was one of the songs that I heard about, I guess, I don't know, through the whispered grapevine or what. And I'm like, I want to hear that. I want to make my own judge, be my own judge of the song instead of having the criticism or the praise, you know, filtered through other people.
Fair enough. And the next song, which we've already discussed as part of the Lucky Town episode, I know we don't have any daylight between us because Happy is, it's a beautiful song. And, mm-hmm. and as we said at the time, I mean, it's interesting because the guy's singing about being happy, but he sounds, would we say, morose?
Yeah. I mean, the best description is that he's content in this song. He's happy and content and not, he's not ecstatic. He's not shouting from the rooftops. Like he described when his kids were born. But you know, there's a certain happiness and a certain contentness that he's managed to. What am I trying to say here? He's finally found the truce with the opposite sex.
I can see that, and as we know, Happy was, I believe, the last song written for this cycle. In fact, it was written so late, it was too late for Lucky Town, right?
I believe that's the case. I believe because it was recorded in January of 92. And so it was just.
Right. That would have been very, very tight to get it on Lucky Town by March.
Right. And well, but going back to what you were saying, but corrected yourself. If you didn't know when it was recorded, it would be the perfect transition song between the two albums.
Right.
I mean, between both musically and lyrically.
Yes, it would, especially the way the synth ends on Happy. And I think, as we mentioned in the Lucky Town episode, to me, the song, musically, it ends on a happier note, however morose he sounds in singing some of the lyrics.
That's a good point. It does.
Well, it does sort of soar. It sort of soars there at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, musically, it just, you're right. You feel his happiness. Even if you didn't feel it through the first 4 minutes of the song, you definitely feel it in the last 30 or so seconds.
Yeah. And that, of course, leads into Part Man, Part Monkey. Another one of my personal favorites, Flynn, as you're aware of.
Yes. Well, as I said, I think if you replace Part Man, Part Monkey here with 30 Days Out,
that would work for me.
There's your 12-song album right there.
Well, Part Man, Part Monkey, which... It was interesting on the Tunnel tour, and then, of course, it was how many different places was it, a B-side in 92?
Yeah, and it just wasn't 92. It got extended into 93 and 94 and, you know, maybe even 95. I think I seem to remember it's on the same CD single as Secret Garden. I think that's one of the reasons that it's so, you know, it's not exactly loved by the hardcore fans, is that it kept coming out on all these... You know, Part Man, Part Monkey on the CD single could have been Sad Eyes. It could have been Seven Angels, but it didn't have to be Part Man, Part Monkey like 10 times.
Let's be honest. It's not a great song. Now, I will say he sort of moved me more with it in 2005 on the Devils and Dust tour with the intro. And I thought that was a cool arrangement. This arrangement here with the session musicians that he used to record Human Touch, it doesn't really work for me. I mean, I'm just being, I'll leave it at that.
You're not the only person to feel that way. And I really liked it when I heard it as the B-side in 92, but you know, time can wear down those kinds of opinions. 30 Days Out, I still love.
Yeah, that's a good one. And Trouble River is also another good one. And as we know, Trouble River was on 18 tracks, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and 30 Days Out had already been released on as a B-side. Now, I guess, so 30 Days Out wasn't on tracks.
Nope.
Was it on 18 tracks?
Nope.
So there's part of the problem. Like on tracks here, he plops on Part Man, Part Monkey, and 30 Days Out, which was also a B-side to the 92 records, was not on tracks. And that was a song that probably should have been.
Right. I mean, that to me, 30 Days Out just freaking rocks.
Yeah, that's actually, now that we're talking about it, and what year the track came out in 98, so it's not like we've talked about this too much in recent years, but yeah, why did he leave 30 Days Out off of tracks? A lot of the other B-sides are here.
I have no idea. I think, is that the only B-side that's not on here?
Is it?
Well, hold on here. Well, I guess Big Payback wasn't on here.
No, it wasn't. No.
Be True was on there. Held Up isn't on here.
Yeah, they were. It wasn't all of them. I guess he felt that some of them, maybe he picked Part Man, Part Monkey because he felt that it fit in better than 30 Days Out. I don't know. But thankfully, Part Man, Part Monkey has not resurfaced any time lately.
Let me take it. It got played in 2008 once with the Easter Egg Band.
What was the impetus for that?
He was in Pennsylvania. I think it was the Hershey Show in August.
Right, right.
2008, and I think that was when there was some controversy going on about teaching evolution or teaching creationism.
Well, it's certainly fertile territory again because, you know, there's a lot of, well, I'm not going to classify it. Let's just say it was a lot of fertile territory right now for that kind of thing.
Yes, yes. But let's, instead of going political, let's go Cali.
Yeah. Now, is this the most autobiographical song he's ever written, Going Cali?
It must be. I can't think of another one. Cautious Man, I don't think is as much about him as this one. This one is, I mean, like freaking line for line, everything happened apparently.
The second verse, packed them next to the faith that he had lost in himself, said his goodbyes, and when the dirty work was done, he turned his wheels into the fading sun. It sounds like he really was feeling beaten up at the time. And I looked over Brian's book, as I generally do before we do these episodes, and he mentions how this song was recorded in January of 91. And this is really sort of a bridge to Lucky Town, because I think most of Human Touch was already done at this point, and you do get it. I mean, like, you hear a lot of the themes. Now, they're happier on Lucky Town, and when we discussed the Lucky Town record, I even was talking about how it seemed to me like almost in order that was telling the story of what was happening in his life with Book of Dreams and Living Proof and all that stuff. This would have fit in there.
Mm-hmm. Lyrically, yeah, it fits in perfectly, but musically, it's another one of the bass-driven songs.
Yes.
And what's interesting to me is that of all the bass-driven songs, the only one he included on one of the albums at the time, Human Touch, was 57 Channels. And I'm going to go ahead and say it, that he picked the worst bass-driven song to release on the album. I think all of these other songs just blow 57 Channels out of the water.
Well, certainly something like Loose Change or this track would have been a better choice, I think, than 57 Channels. As we know, I think they saw 57 Channels sort of in a pop mode, regardless of whether it was on the bass or not. As we remarked in that episode, I never really understood how that was the second single, but...
I didn't either. And I think there was some guilt by association with the songs on Tracks this four. I mean, people said, yeah, Going Cali. Well, I heard it the first time at 57 Channels. I don't need to hear it again. But this is 10 times, 100 times a better song.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to revisit these things. And I've said this before on our show, just because obviously I listen to stuff a little bit differently when we're going to sit here and talk about it for an hour. I haven't really considered any of these themes in a while, and you do wonder, like, maybe again it was just this one was just too personal for him. I mean, it laid it out there in such a way. Maybe he just decided, no, I'm not going to do this right now, because also if he had put it out, then it probably would have been played live. It's interesting that on the Move to California song that resulted, I think the Long Goodbye was the most generic.
Yes. Yes, I mean, that was generic rocker number three, right?
Yes.
And whereas this one would have had a whole different feel to the Human Touch album.
Yes.
But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't quite there. With the Human Touch album, he wasn't quite at that point where all the voices in his head quieted down. And that didn't happen until Lucky Town.
Yeah, there are two final tracks on this disc, and they are not from the 92-93 sessions. Back in Your Arms, which is the next song, was for the, well, we believe it's for the Relationship record, right?
Yes, that's what we suspect. I don't think we have any concrete confirmation on that just yet.
But it really is here because it's an alternative to the Greatest Hits sessions, which is where this version was recorded.
Right.
This is a song I love. And as we know, in the last 25 years or so of the Showstoppers he's written, this is really one of the biggest. When he plays this live, It is the definition of showstopper. If you look at many of the versions that have been performed, and I know you like to bring up the Cleveland 2009 version, which really was, even as we have joked before, he even said at the end, thank you very much.
Good night, everybody. And then Charlie plays that cheesy organ riff.
Yeah, they did not nail it here. Now, we, of course, saw the recording sessions of this because it was in Blood Brothers, the documentary, where it was, we saw the band doing it, and it was a very sparse arrangement. And at that was our first experience with the song. And everyone went, oh my God, this song is incredible. And then when it came out on tracks, they had finished it and there were overdubs, and the song still didn't feel fully realized to me, and it doesn't in the studio, certainly nothing like it does live.
No, I think the word you're looking for is, or the phrase is, too polished.
Yes, that could be it.
I think it, when they showed it on the documentary, it was pretty, I don't want to say rough, but it was you could say it was a rough mix of it, and Bruce's vocals had definitely had more of a, almost of a live feel to them.
Yes.
And then in here, here they basically went in and kind of polished all the hard edges around it. And unfortunately, in many cases, those hard edges are what gave the song more of its soul.
Yeah. And this song has one of the quintessential Clarence solos. I know we were talking earlier in the show. Unfortunately, it's been 10 years since he passed, and you just listen to the power of what he did here. And it's just beautiful.
Yeah, I totally agree. He, I think it's, you could almost say it shows off, you know, him and Danny. I mean, Danny's solo is,
that's true, that's too. That's, yeah, one we of shouldn't his, forget Danny.
Right, that's one of his trademark solos, as far as I'm concerned. And you know, one thing I gotta wonder is, this easily could have been a hit in the same vein as Secret Garden.
Well, this is, I think, a better song than Secret Garden. I know when Caroline was on in the last episode, I talked about how powerful Secret Garden was for me as used in Jerry Maguire, and I think that is 100% true. But I think just as a song, Back in Your Arms is a much more passionate, romantic, just powerful take on what the singer is singing about, that he has lost this girl and all he wants to do is literally feel her back in his arms.
Right. And I feel, you put this in a movie, a popular rom-com, you know, in the same vein as Jerry Maguire, and this is a top five hit. Or, I mean, at least it could have been in the 90s. I don't think now it would work.
You know, you know what I'm thinking about now? Back in Your Arms is almost so good. It's almost too on the nose for a movie in a way. Like, when you're looking for music, and we were talking about this with Caroline, you want it to complement the film. Back in Your Arms is such a significant song. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it would become the film, and you don't want that from your music. I mean, the brilliance of Secret Garden in Jerry Maguire is how it comes in. They don't even use that much of it in a way, at least lyrically, and it just works because of the power of Danny's organ and the sax. It might overpower the images that it was attached to. I don't know. I mean, obviously, we'd have to see what it was. But to me, Back in Your Arms is a more significant song than Secret Garden.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, I would have preferred this one on Greatest Hits rather than Secret Garden. And you know, I never thought about that way in terms of the music overpowering a film. But that's a good point. But I still think it would have been a huge hit at, you know, part of some rom-com in the, you know, in the mid to late 90s.
The thing about it is Secret Garden, I think, is a little bit more subtle, whereas Back in Your Arms, it really wears the heart on the sleeve.
That's true.
The way he wails, I just want to be back in your arms. You know, again, if you put that over images of a couple, it's almost like, well, you know, it's too much in a way, in my mind. But again, I'd have to see the circumstance.
I mean, could it go over credits?
Oh, certainly. I think it could. But also, you'd have to think of the movie. Where would it end with where the song fits, where the guy is screaming he wants her back in her arms? Most movies have probably concluded with the couple back together. So I don't know. Again, we're getting off track.
That's a good point. But still, we agree it's one of his greatest love songs. I think it's his greatest love song.
Just and, incredibly shocking that it winds up buried on Tracks Disc 4. And I know we say this a lot, but this is a song. Back in Your Arms, for any other artist, would be played every night. I mean, that's not even a debate. Any other artist would be falling all over themselves if they had this song.
Yeah. And then Bruce plays it, you know, what, 5 times on the reunion tour, and how many times since? Like, you know, at least with the E Street Band. Like, what, 5, 4?
The thing that's always fascinated me about that is he clearly knows. I mean, The minute the song starts, he hears the crowd reaction. The thing about Back in Your Arms is, as an outtake, it gets such, the Cleveland being the best example, it gets such an amazing reaction from the crowd, whether they know the song or not. I mean, this is pure magic when it's happening.
Yeah, his intro is about, if you know, that's the door slamming on your face after you've done something really, really bad. He really builds it up perfectly. And that's, unfortunately, I'm sure that's from experience, personal experience, but that intro really, I mean, it resonates very strongly with a lot of people, if not all people.
Oh, yeah. It's just, what a great song
it is. We've got about 10 minutes about one song here.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to Brothers Under the Bridge, and we'll finish up. This, of course, is a song that is related to the Jode record and was featured prominently on that tour. This is a high-quality track.
Oh, absolutely. It's to me, it completes his Vietnam trilogy in some fashion. Going from Shut Out the Light, that covers the Vietnam vet when he first comes home. Born in the USA, you know, 10 years later, what exactly he's been doing. And now another 10 years, and the guy is living in the foothills in California. So it just tells the whole story.
Yes, it does. And this is a particularly sad tale. His daughter is looking for him, and the protagonist is singing to her, "Come Veterans Day, I sat in the stands of my dress blues. I held your mother's hand when they passed with the red, white, and blue. One a minute, you're right there, and something slips." This is a song about someone who is slipping away from society, as you noted, living in the hills of Los Angeles. And in many ways, even though, of course, this song is many years before, this sort of storytelling and caricature, if not necessarily the musical flavor, would seem to fit on Western Stars to me. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. From the storytelling perspective and just the mental attitude and the mental place that the protagonist is in, that's definitely, because a lot of guys on Western Stars are slipping away, and this guy, he's on his way.
Now, refresh my memory. Was this song played? It was played once on the reunion tour, right? In Barcelona?
Yes. The second night, April 11th, 1999.
Yeah, that was the one night, speaking of your trilogy thought, that was the one night where he did the hybrid partial acoustic into full band Born in the USA.
Yeah, and if memory serves, he did he did USA prior to Brothers. And I think if he had reversed that, if he had played, what he did was he played Born in the USA, first bit acoustic, then the full band, and then he went to Brothers, and then he went into Light of Day. I always felt that was kind of a clunky sequencing, if just from the pacing perspective. And so if he had done Brothers first, then segued into the Born in the USA acoustic, and then the full band to really get the place going, and then you slam into Light of Day, I think that would have worked much better.
See, I always felt at that point he was trying to protect the song, and that's why it was partial acoustic, full band, and then followed by the Brothers Under the Bridge, which sort of, it gave it, much like he did in 2014 in the United States with The Wall, where The Wall was played in the Born in the USA, he was really giving it in a context where it would be very hard to misunderstand the meaning of Born in the USA.
Right, but you just said The Wall into Born in the USA.
That's true.
If he had played Brothers into Born in the USA, I think it would have been, I think the pacing at least would have been much better, much sharper.
Yeah, well, it was a very weird sequence to be sure, and it was never repeated again.
No, well, in fact, that was the only full band performance of USA on that tour, and
the only performance of Brothers Under the Bridge is with the E Street Band, or Bridge, singular.
Right, we got to keep the song straight.
until what? I mean, he did it in 2014, right? So yes. It's, yeah, both of them got a long, long rest after that one outing.
The quality of the songwriting here, and it's needless to say, in the entire Vietnam trilogy, Shut Out the Light and Born in the USA, Born in the USA in particular, one of his best written songs, in my opinion. This is really brilliant stuff. And I don't think they've ever all been played together, except maybe there was one night in San Jose in 1996 on the Joe Tour. I actually helped bring that about because I requested Shut Out the Light. I gave Landau a note before the show, and it was, I think, the only night where he played Shut Out the Light, Born in the USA, and Brothers Under the Bridge all in a row. But it was just really, really cool to see those songs together. And I guess we'll have to go back and look. Do you recall, were the three ever played together anywhere else?
I don't think so. I think out of that trio, the Shut Out the Light will be the biggest wild card. And that hasn't been played. I don't think it's been played since the Joe Tour. So, but whereas obviously USA and Brothers Under the Bridge have been.
Yes, they have. And, you know, again, just a beautiful song and a really fitting conclusion, I think, to Trax Disc 4. I don't know if there's any other outtakes from Joe. They certainly didn't appear on Trax. We know there are the daytime sessions, as we mentioned earlier. That's really related to a different record, one that hasn't been released yet, and maybe we'll get a chance to hear that sometime soon.
Hopefully someday. But let me quickly correct myself, Hal.
Okay.
Shut Out the Light was indeed done on the Devils and Dust tour. So.
Oh, okay. Right. Was it on the pump organ?
Yes.
Okay. I do remember that now.
Yes. So yeah, I think the daytime and the nighttime album done in the summer of 95 are definitely different projects.
So, and that's about it for this show. We're going to wrap it up. Now, we do want to tell everyone about the next show because we're very excited about it. We're going to have the four men who are responsible over the 40-year history of Backstreet's magazine for running the show there. What are their titles, Flynn? Were they editor-in-chief? I don't want to get it wrong.
I think it was basically managing editor. They may not have concrete or firm titles. Everybody did what needed to be done. So, but I think managing editor is probably the best one. And founder, of course, and you go back to Charles Cross.
And very fortunately, we have, so together we have Charles Cross, Eric Flanagan, John Pont, Chris Phillips, all going to be on the show with us. Or actually, it's going to be two episodes. The two will comprise our season finale. And we recorded this about a week ago now. We had a great time. The four have never spoken anywhere together publicly. And there's a lot of great information that we think people are going to enjoy hearing about the history of the magazine, the relationship between the magazine and the organization, the fans, E Street Nation. I'm looking forward to hearing the final product.
Yeah, we haven't finished putting it all together yet, but it was a lot of fun, and I learned a lot of stuff, and I think everyone else are really going to enjoy it.
Yeah, it was a real treat for us. It really was. So be on the lookout for that. I believe the first part is going to be out July 6th, and the second part will likely be out July 15th. So put it in your calendars.
Well, just download the show as you normally do when it comes out, and you'll be fine.
That is true. The good thing about podcasts is they just sort of show up there automatically.
That is a cool thing about subscribing to podcasts, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and on that note, we're going to do our usual spiel here at the end of the show. None But the Brave is a presentation of Bull Market Entertainment and soon to be a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. If you want to reach out to us, you can find us on Twitter at NBTB Podcast, and our website is nonebutthebravepodcast.com.
So for Hal Schwartz, I'm Flynn McLean saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild Podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.